Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start in the West. Game two of the Pelicans-Warriors was supposed to be about one thing and one thing only, the return of Steph Curry. And damn, was it ever. Get a load of the reaction when he checked into the game with 4:20 left in the first quarter.
For the first time in 5 weeks, a rousing ovation for the return of the two-time MVP.
Well, so you'd expect that, right? First game back in more than a month, he's probably going to have to knock off a little bit of rust. You know, find his shot, feel out the game, get into a rhythm with his teammates. Yeah, either that or within seconds of stepping on the floor, do this.
Here's Curry firing.
Man's game. Yeah.
He hasn't played in a month. That's all you got to say. And this is his first shot.
This guy's barely 1 foot onto the floor and already knocking in a three. I mean, ridiculous. Almost as ridiculous as him busting out that MJ switch hands layup.
Curry on the drive.
Man's game.
Curry switching hands to put it home. And he's looked quite good to this point.
I think he can let that concern go. Steph looks great.
Steph looks amazing. 28 points, 27 minutes, 8 of 15 shooting, 5 of 10 from deep. And it looked like he had not missed a beat, let alone missing a month and a full round of the playoffs. If Steph Curry rolls off an injury like that and into a game like that, that's scary. I mean, really scary. Now, don't get it twisted, though. That was not a catwalk. Not a cakewalk, I should say. You've got New Orleans, and they were leading when Curry came into the game. It would have been very easy for them to collapse when he hit that three and the building exploded, but they didn't. See, these Pelicans, they're tough. They're well-coached. They don't back down. These guys do not back down. Like when Rajon Rondo tried to get in Draymond Green's head in the most disgusting way possible. Draymond's at the foul line. He's made his first free throw. Rondo grabs the ball before the ref reaches it and rubs the ball over his sweaty forehead and his face. I mean, it's revolting. It's disgusting. It's petty. I love it. It was awesome. And that was after he tried to high-five Draymond in game one after Green missed a free throw. But that's not the first time Rondo tried to get into Draymond's head last night. In fact, he got in his face at the end of the first half. Maybe you saw that. I know my man Charles Barkley saw that. He saw that showdown, got him all hot and bothered back at the TNT studio.
What do you want to call it, Chuckster?
I just want somebody to punch him in the face.
Which one? American Express Halftime Report.
I really do. I just want somebody to punch him in the face.
Why you don't like Draymond?
Mario J in Atlanta.
I want to punch him in the face.
Why you don't like Draymond? I'm just telling you, I want to punch his ass in the face. I do.
Why? Why?
Relax,
what makes you upset?
You asked me a question. I gave you a question.
I didn't ask you to punch him. I said why.
Get it. When Chuck get like that, just leave him alone.
No, I like it. Okay.
Let me tell you something. When they were all laughing at that, notice the one guy who was not laughing. Chuck was not laughing. Let me read that quote back to you one more time. Quote, I just want somebody to punch him in the face. Now, you know Chuck. Chuck might have been clowning. Chuck might have just been goofing around as they were coming back to the studio. I mean, there's no way he meant that, right? There's no way he meant I want somebody or even I myself want to punch that guy in the face. Had to be clowning around. Except for this, check the follow-up quote. I want to punch him in the face so bad. I'm just telling you, I want to punch his ass in the face. I do. End quote. This is so good. I mean, this is second round. Second round, early May. We've already got Drake and Perk getting into it. I will get to that later on. And Chuckster is threatening to punch Draymond in the face. I mean, what's going on? It'll probably end there, right? No need to go any further, right? Wrong. Because Draymond, of course, was asked about it after the game, and Draymond responded as you would expect Draymond to respond.
A lot of guys talk on TV, stand behind a microphone or a TV screen. The fact of the matter is, if you feel that strongly about something, he's seen me a million times. If you feel that strongly about it, then punch me in my face when you see me. If you're not gonna punch me in my face when you see me, then shut up. It's no different than somebody sitting behind a computer screen tweeting, I'll knock you out and you never see him in life. Well, he's seen me a bunch of times and he'll see me again this year. Punch me in the face when you see me, or if not, no one cares what you would have done. You old and it is what it is. So if you ain't gonna punch me when you see me, then stop talking about it. Period.
Draymond v. Chuck. That does not sound like it's over. In fact, that's the closest thing to an invitation to punch somebody in the face that I think I've ever heard. And Draymond didn't stop there. He essentially called Charles, compared him to a Twitter tough guy, and then he called him old. Quote, punch me in the face when you see me, or if not, no one cares what you would have done, end quote. And that right there is one of the best quotes ever. And if that's not, then this is, quote, you old. And it is what it is. So if you ain't gonna punch me when you see me, then stop talking about it. Period. End quote. It's incredible. It's fantastic. Keep it coming. I mean, think about this whole situation for one moment. Steph Curry returns to Golden State last night. They take a 2-0 series lead over the Pelicans. It looks like basketball Voltron is being reunited, and Golden State could be starting a run toward their third title in 4 years. But we're talking about Draymond and Chuck punching each other in the face. And if you look at me, if you hear me, you don't hear me complaining. Not even one bit. Because this is awesome. This is why the NBA playoffs are awesome. Look, I know the NHL playoffs are a grind. I know they're the toughest postseason in sports. But you don't have guys trolling each other with throwback jerseys or platinum-selling artists beefing with players or former players threatening to punch current players in the face on a nightly basis. In other words, NBA action. It's fantastic. So good. 1-800-636-8686. Take either side of that beef. Where do you come out? You saw Steph Curry last night. It's incredible. That guy can miss a month and a first round of playoff action and not miss anything at all. No rust, nothing. He looked amazing. And if he's going to play like that, it's them and everybody else once again.
Hey, Jim Rome.
Hey, Steph Curry.
Hey, Jim Rome.
God, I love it. Still calling me out after all this time. Hey, Steph.
Hey, Jim Rome.
Hey, Steph Curry.
Hey, Jim Rome.
What's up, my man?
In case you forgot, I wanted to remind you of what the NBA is.
What?
A man's game.
Oh! Micah Hyde. Micah, good to have you on. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing, Jim?
Good, good, Micah. All right, so you're wrapping up your, you did wrap up your first season, and now you're entering your second season with the Bills. Let me start right there. How different does it feel now that you've got a year under your belt with the Bills, and you have now established yourself as one of the leaders in that locker room?
Oh, it's awesome coming into this offseason, being able to already know the playbook, and basically just build off of what I did last year. I'm talking with the other guys in the secondary and in the defense, and we're trying to just build off what we finished up with last year and trying to make the defense that much better.
Now, for years I've been talking to Buffalo players and coaches about what it would be like to get Buffalo back to the postseason, and you were part of that team that got them there last year. So when you look back on that experience, what sticks out to you the most about it?
Well, I think that, coming here last offseason and realizing that, I haven't been to playoffs in about 17 years or whatever, that was obviously the key to make it to the playoffs. But I think we have a whole different mindset this year just because we tasted it last year. The community tasted the playoffs last year. I think that we're more focused on, how far we can get. Obviously, it's one day at a time. You got to win one game at a time. But I don't think it's just, let's make it to the playoffs this year. It's beyond that, and I think we all understand that. And that's why I think we're going to have a better football team this year.
Bills safety, Micah Hyde is my guest. From the outside, it seemed like last year's team had a really good bond, really, really good chemistry. There have been some changes to the roster, but that'll happen every single year. So how do you go about developing that kind of chemistry once again? Is it something you consciously have to do, or because of the way training camp is structured and the fact you're around each other all the time, does it simply take care of itself?
Yeah, it does. It does. It really does. I think that, like you mentioned, training camp, around each other seems like 24/7. We wake up early in the morning, we're with each other late at night, and it just slowly develops over time. You slowly get to meet guys in the locker room. I think Coach does a good job of he'll make sure that we all have chances to meet the other side of the football, because a lot of teams, offensive side doesn't really talk to the defensive side and vice versa. But on this team, he makes it a point, to get to meet the other side of the football and introduce yourself, talk about your family, talk about your friends. And he even has times in the team meeting where guys will stand up and talk about their friends and family. And that way, everyone gets to know each other. And he'll quiz everybody, too. He'll say, hey, tell me what Micah Hyde's parents' names were or what they are. And, people were expected to know. So I think Sean McDermott does a good job with that. And the chemistry would develop over time.
I know you have guys over to your house, too, and we'll get to that in a minute. Now, last season, you had a huge year, and you were named to the Pro Bowl. You were a fifth-round draft pick. You've had to battle for everything that you have in that league. So what did it mean to you to get that Pro Bowl nod?
It was awesome. It just shows that, I'm gaining some respect in this league. But I think that the ultimate thing is I didn't play in it. I had a little injury that kept me out of it. So I still have that same mentality. Like I'm still yet to play in the Pro Bowl, even though, you know, I got voted in, which is cool, and I gained that respect. But, my goals are still beyond that. Obviously we got the team goals. We want to win a championship here. We're going to bring one back to Buffalo. And, you know, it's a process. We understand that. We're trying to take that one day at a time. But at the same time, I have my own individual goals. And, you know, one of them is the Pro Bowl. One of them is All Pro, all that stuff. But there's more to it. And I can't wait to see what the future holds.
Micah Hyde, my guest. Now, if we go back to a year ago, when you were a free agent, legend has it you were kind of hoping that you would end up someplace warm. But then you get the call from your agent that Buffalo really, really wants to talk to you. What was it like when you first visited the Bills, and how would you describe your first year in Buffalo?
You know, I think that the free agency process is, to me, it was amazing. Because it was kind of that first time in my life where I felt wanted. Coming in college, I think I signed with Iowa the very last day before signing day. You know, I was kind of that last guy they just threw in on the roster and said, let's see if this guy can make it. And, you know, same thing. I was drafted fifth round to Green Bay. And so last year was that first time where I got the experience, you know, being wanted. And even though there wasn't a lot of teams that wanted me, the first time I stepped foot in Buffalo, these coaches and players and everybody just showed me so much love. So that was eye-opening to me. And, I always said I want to play somewhere warm, but at the end of the day, you know, I'm from Ohio. I went to Iowa, played in Green Bay, and I'm in Buffalo. So I'm a cold weather guy, even though, you know, I try to get to San Diego with my fiance as much as possible. But I'm a cold weather guy, so I wouldn't have it any other way.
And Micah, the 619's the spot, isn't it? How nice is San Diego?
Oh, my gosh.
When you show up there and there's a sign that says America's finest city, it might be, right?
Dude, it is, for sure. That's why any chance we get, if it's a long weekend, you can find me in the 619.
Micah Hyde, my guest. You know, you're one of the leaders on that defense, and you're known for hosting the DBs to watch games. As an example, Tre'Davious White said, quote, "Micah Hyde, he's a rich guy, and he has a nice house that he just got built. So we go over there and we watch a little Thursday night football, Monday night football. I think I'm hesitant to go over there again because you've got to take your shoes off because he's a little bougie. Look, you can't wear your shoes in his house," end quote.
That's crazy, right? Because the way I was taught, like, if there's carpet in the house, you take your shoes off. Well, obviously, some places weren't, you know, some people weren't taught that. But we squashed that the other day. You know, they came over. We watched the Cavs game when Bron hit the last second shot against the Pacers. So, you know, we were all celebrating, having a good time. So, you know, we're beyond that. They can come over anytime they want now. They do have to take their shoes off still, but they can still come over.
Yeah, right. I mean, just take your kicks off. It's not too much to ask, right? It's a nice house.
Exactly.
Respect
exactly.
The house. All right, yep. Before I let you go, Micah, the league has taken steps to penalize players from lowering their heads to initiate contact. So I've got to ask, as a safety, what's your reaction to that rule?
You know what? We had a discussion a couple weeks ago, and it's difficult, man. It's hard, especially as a defensive player, defensive back. Ball's in the air. You want to go get it just like the receiver. And if the receiver's going up to get it, you want to try to stop him from doing so. So I think that the bang-bang plays in the middle of the field you know, as far as spearing and keeping your head out, I think that's possible. But when a running back is running at you with his head down and getting, you know, a foot above the ground, you know, I'm not just going to stand straight up and let him run right through me. I got to get lower than him. You know, lowest man wins. I've been taught that since Pee Wee football. So it's difficult, man. It's a violent football game. There's ways to take some injuries out, but there's also, you know, it's a violent football game. You know, these are grown men. Freaks of nature going out there running as fast as they could, running as fast as they can and hitting as hard as they can. So at the end of the day, man, it's difficult. I'm not the guy that has all the answers to make it safer. I'm not that guy. But I think that penalizing the defensive players like they have been is not cool because they want to see, the best product, the best players on the football field, but at the same time, they trying to limit us from doing what we can do. So, like I said, I don't have the answers, but I guess it's another discussion for another day.
Micah Hyde, yeah, but one more part of that discussion, because I think you bring up a really valid point. I mean, are they going to call it both ways? As an example, you've got plenty of running backs and receivers who are going to lower their helmet before contact. Yeah. So do you think the rule is going to be applied evenly to both defensive players and offensive players, or are they only going to focus on defensive players?
Honestly, it's an offensive game, man. We all understand that with defensive players. No, it's not gonna be fair both ways. I'll be a fool if I said yes.
Micah Hyde, my guest. Micah, one last thought. We talked about San Diego. I got to ask about Spain. You went to Spain. You went to Barcelona. Yeah. You took in a game there. What was that whole experience like?
Oh, my gosh. That was amazing. I had no idea it was like that over there. You know, obviously you hear about soccer in Europe and all that, but watching Messi play, it's like watching Kobe play or watching Jordan play. Like, we were, you know, third, fourth row, and he scored a 600th goal, and I was like, I went crazy. My fiance got it on camera. You know, all of our buddies were there with us, and we just went crazy. It was such a good time.
What about Spain? Where else did you guys go? What was that like?
Spain was awesome too. Anytime you can travel, I think that's my addiction now, is just traveling, because once we can get out of the country and go experience new places, you know, we've been to Thailand, been to Morocco, Spain, you know, been to the Caribbean, all that stuff. It's just a new experience. It's eye-opening to see these different countries. So, it was awesome, man. I love Spain.
I totally agree. So where do you still want to go?
I think we're going to do the Africa trip. Yeah. I think that's in our future. Maybe hit South Africa. And then also try to do Australia and New Zealand. Hopefully that's in the near future.
You know, I haven't even laid out my thoughts on what happened to the Raptors, and I want to get to that, but I'm going to skip that for a minute and skip to the other brawl. Now, I want to make this clear, and I need time to do it. That's a bad night for Toronto. A really, really bad night for Toronto and the Raptors. They blew a double-digit lead and home court to their bully in the worst way possible. But that's not the only fight they lost. They lost another battle. Drake v. Kendrick. Drake v. Kendrick Perkins. Now, let me get something out of the way quickly. I know that Drake is a polarizing cat. A lot of people like him. A lot of people don't like him. I don't really have an opinion, honestly. I don't care. I don't care either way. Drake has never done anything to me, so I'm not going to do anything to Drake. However, I will offer a piece of free advice. And that piece of free advice is this. Anybody can do anything in this world if they really set their mind to it, except intimidate Kendrick Perkins. It's not happening. Not now, not ever. But somehow, Aubrey, Drake Graham, and Kendrick Ladale Perkins got into a war of words as the teams were heading to the locker room at halftime. Kendrick said it was all very simple. Quote, "I was bleeping with Serge, my old teammate. I wasn't talking to Drake." Perk then elaborated in more detail to Woj. Quote, "I was telling him we about to win this game. And Drake butted in talking bleep to me, so I said something back to him." End quote. And what exactly did you say back, Kendrick? Quote, "He said something slick, so I said something back." Quote, "Sit your ass down and watch the game." End quote. So let me jump in right there. If Kendrick Perkins tells me to sit my ass down and watch the game, I am sitting my ass down and watching the game. I'm sitting my ass down and watching that game better than I ever have before. Any person in their right mind is doing that. I don't care that Kendrick Perkins is not playing and wearing a suit. Kendrick Perkins is still Kendrick Perkins. Kendrick Perkins is still listed at 6'10", 270. Kendrick Perkins is still one very bad dude. The list of people in the NBA to whom I would talk smack to goes like this. 1, everybody. 2, then Kendrick Perkins. And no, this is not the first time that Drake has gotten into it with the opposition. Not even the first time he's gotten into it with the opposition in this postseason. There was the jawing with John Wall. The remarks for Kelly Oubre Jr. where he yelled, "You're a bum." Now, you know where I come out on people calling each other bums. Let me make this very clear, though. John Wall and Kelly Oubre Jr. are not Kendrick Perkins. Kendrick Perkins is built like a Mack truck. I would sooner throw with a Mack truck traveling at 50 miles per hour than I would with Kendrick Perkins. I would have a better chance of beating LeBron one-on-one than Drake has of beating Perkins in a fight. Jawing with Perkins at halftime is one thing. Doing it again after the game, especially after that game where your team just lost in brutal fashion, is even worse. But it happened again. Now, I don't know who started it, but it better not have been Drake. Not after how that game ended. If your team loses the way your team lost and Perk talk some junk on the way by, you smile and you wave. That's not what happened. Both guys were going at each other, and Drake started to follow Perkins into the tunnel. According to Toronto Star columnist Bruce Arthur, quote, "This went all the way into the tunnel with Drake calling Perkins a bleeping bleep and calling for him to come out. I'm here in real life," he said. He was mad. I mean, I understand that you're here in real life, but Drake, I want you to be here in real life for a long life. I mean, a long time. I know you love the Raptors. I respect that. I want you to have your team's back. I really do. But nobody wants to see you eating your lunch through a straw. Because if you keep barking at Perk, there's a chance that that's exactly what's going to happen. Especially when he wasn't even barking at you in the first place. If Kendrick Perkins is talking junk to his dude Serge, let Kendrick Perkins talk junk to his dude Serge. I mean, if that's the case, Drake should probably talk junk to Serge as well. What I'm saying is, whatever you do, do not be on the wrong side or the opposite side of Kendrick Perkins. And if you're getting the sense that I respect this guy, it's because I do. Best part of the whole scene is, as the Cavs were getting ready to leave the locker room and head for the bus, a member of the team security staff asked Perk if he wanted an escort to the bus. I mean, sorry, you're asking Kendrick Perkins if he needs security. Kendrick Perkins is security. That's why he's there. He's security personified. He's not with the Cavs to be a security guard. But he also doesn't need a security guard to be with the Cavs. Actually, part of the reason he is there is to be a security guard for the other guys on the team. Of course, Perk shook it off. Quote, "I'm fine." What's he going to do? What's he going to do? If he's smart, nothing. If he's really smart, apologize. Drake, you don't want any of that. Why are you doing that? Why are you going there? This is not John Wall. This is not Kelly Oubre Jr. I mean, what's next? You going to roll up on Charles Oakley? Your team's got a lot to worry about right now. Don't give me anything else. And you really don't want me talking junk if you come from ahead to melt down like that. 1-800-636-8686. Let's see. Not taking that call. Not taking that call. Don't really want to take that call. Man, that thing turned sour fast. From great to bad. This email says, "Drake is just a glorified poser who at the most would last 10 seconds in a fight with Kendrick Perkins. And that's if Drake doesn't run from Perkins first. All because the Raptors once again got owned by Cleveland. Once again in an epic choke job fashion." George and C-Bus. Yeah, again, I mean, Drake's kind of a polarizing figure. You like him or you really don't like him. I'm neither. I don't care. I don't have a dog in that fight. I don't even have an opinion. Like I said, Drake's never done anything to me. I don't care. But some free advice. Don't mess with Perk. Number one, he's not messing with you. And number two, it's not going to go well for you. Be one thing if Perk singled Drake out, but he didn't. He was talking junk to his dude, a former teammate. At Steve, PHX, tweets, "Ward Kendrick Perkins picking up Drake and using him to wipe the sweat off his face." We are joined by John Lynch. John, it's so good to have you on the program. How are you?
What's going on, Jim? Always good to be on with you.
You too, John. Great to visit. Thanks so much. Now, you wrapped up your second draft as team GM. I've got to first ask, how different did this one feel after you had already gone through one as a GM?
Well, I think we felt much more prepared. Last year, it was the first time we had gone through it, and you know, Kyle was a first-time head coach. It was the first time I had been in a draft room on draft day, and so it was a new experience. I think we were real proud of how we came out of year one, but no doubt about it, because it was much more of a year-long process. It was a more well-oiled machine, and you know, we like I mentioned, we were very proud of our first draft. It was very fruitful. We had a lot of guys play a lot of snaps in their rookie years, and you know, thinking really highly of that class moving forward. And you know, it's early. I think the time will tell on all of these drafts, but we like what we came out of this year's draft as well.
John Lynch joining us. So, John, let's talk about what you end up with. You take offensive tackle Mike McGlinchey from Notre Dame with the 9th pick overall. As you were watching tape on him, what made you feel like he was the right guy for you?
Well, this was an interesting draft. You know, I think credit to the guys up front, John Dorsey and Dave Gettleman and their organizations. They kept it so quiet, their intentions, and so that coupled with the fact that there were 4 quarterbacks that were likely going to go in the top 10, we knew that, you know, we weren't in that quarterback market. Thankfully, we had Jimmy Garoppolo, who we acquired and then locked up. And so we could focus really on players that we felt could make us better. We were looking for a cornerstone player who'd be a part of us for a long, long time and be a difference maker. You know, as the process kept going on, you know, we watched a lot of Notre Dame with Quentin Nelson, obviously, being there. And you know, Quentin Nelson is such a unique player and a mauler, and just dominates the guy in front of him. It was hard when you were watching Notre Dame not just to focus on him, but the more we started watching Quentin, all of a sudden you saw the guy next to him continually do his job over and over and over. And when we really started the study in earnest on Mike, he just checked every box. You know, the more you watched it, he really was a dominant player. He was a tremendous scheme fit for what we did. A dynamic and explosive finisher, the way he played. He played with tremendous passion and competitiveness. Mentally tough. I think he was, if not, you know, by measure of the Wonderlic, I think he had the highest score this year. So incredibly bright. And then, you know, I think the thing that probably cinched it for him, when we went to the combine, you have these visits where you know, they call them the 60 visits. You get 60 of them, you get 15 minutes. And we really try not to put too much stock in those, because it's 15 minutes and you can be swayed one way or the other. And there's so much that goes into it. You don't want to let that happen. But there are guys each and every year that kind of grab you. And Mike was one of those guys. I think there were 3 guys that stood out above the rest in terms of just owning the room. And when he left, everybody kind of looked at each other and said, wow, that's a different difference maker as a person. He's going to be a program changer in terms of just his presence. And so I think you couple all of that, the play, the spirit that he embodies, and then the person that he is, it really became a no-brainer for us.
John Lynch, general manager of the 49ers, joining us. Hey, John, sidebar, you know, I always enjoy talking to players about what it's like for them to receive a phone call during the draft. So what's it like for you to make that phone call, knowing that you're delivering news that guys have been dreaming about for their entire lives, a life-changing telephone call?
It is so cool. You know, I'm getting chills talking to you about it right now, and that's what happens every time I make that call, whether it's Mike McGlinchey with the 9th pick or Richie James from Middle Tennessee with the 240th pick. I get chills because I've been there before. I know that it's a life-changing moment for these kids. Different guys receive it differently. You know, it's fun. It's fun to hear their families in the background. It's fun to hear the excitement, sometimes tears. It really, you understand that you're affecting these guys' life in a big and positive way, and it's really cool to be a part of that. I think one of the coolest things about this job.
We're talking to John Lynch. You know, in talking about the draft, Kyle Shanahan said that the team's first second-round pick was Jimmy G. Now, I'd argue that turned out to be a pretty good second-round pick. Hey, John, what were your expectations for him when you first made the trade, knowing that it was in the middle of a season? And then what do you make of how well he's played so far?
Yeah, so we had done a lot of studies on Jimmy in the off season when Kyle and I first arrived. Kyle had a lot of teach tapes in terms of what he was looking for at the quarterback position. It had various guys. Kirk Cousins was on there. Tom Brady's on there a lot. Peyton Manning. I mean, but Jimmy Garoppolo kept showing up. And so that spoke to me that a guy who hadn't played much football kept showing up as the standard, what we're looking for. And a lot of that's just his talent, his ability to throw the football efficiently, quickly, accurately. And like I said, it was a limited sample size. We hadn't had much film to go off of, but that's the one thing we knew, how talented he was. And so we had pursued that with the Patriots, got shut down quickly. Something changed for them. And, you know, as the story goes, they kind of reached out to us. And, you know, for a second-round draft choice, it made a lot of sense. So once you acquire him, you say, okay, what do we do? And C.J. Beathard was a rookie starting for us and getting better himself. This is where I really applaud Kyle Shanahan. He, you know, Kyle kind of got us all together and he said, listen, guys, I've been through this before. And I was right there with him that we're going to play Jimmy when it's right to play him. And if that doesn't happen this year, then we're not going to make it happen. And I understand we have to make a decision on him, but what we're not going to do is ruin him by putting him in there too early. And so I give a lot of credit to Jimmy. And this is one of the reasons we ended up locking him up. Just the way he went to work on learning a new scheme. A lot of people say, well, he's been in the league 4 years, and that's true. He had gotten better watching Tom Brady, but he had not played in our system, which is completely different from the Patriots, and ours is very tough and complex. And so he worked extremely hard day in, and he'd be here at night. When I'd leave at 10:30, he was still here grinding to learn the system. Kyle still waited 4 weeks, and I think that was hard to do because we were so excited to put him on the field. But we waited till we felt like he could go out there and have success. And we, you know, when he eventually did, it was a limited game plan and whatnot. But I think that patience really paid off because when he went out there, he was in a position where he could have success. And he, you know, in many ways, I think it was a confluence of things. Our players, a lot of rookies we played getting better, but he certainly had an impact. I think the great ones make everyone around them better. And Jimmy did that for our receivers, for our offensive linemen, even for our defense. He made everybody on our team better. And I think that's the mark of a great quarterback.
Well, that's something right there. When your quarterback makes your defense better. John Lynch joining us. John, before you go, speaking of the defense, earlier this offseason you went out, you signed Richard Sherman, which to me is a fascinating pickup. What was the process that you went through when it came to evaluating him? And then how was the recruiting process like with him?
It was a lot of fun. He's a guy I've known for quite a while. You know, before that, we had tried to secure a trade and actually agreed to a trade with the Broncos with Aqib Talib. Aqib was very respectful in talking to us and knew we had exciting things going on here, but really didn't like the idea of being traded. And if so, wanted to be traded a couple places. You know, we kind of have a philosophy. We want guys that want to be here. And so we moved on from that. And I knew something would come our way because we had a need at that position. Richard Sherman was then released. And, you know, the thing we did, knowing that it might happen, is we were the first people to call. You know, as soon as that deadline, I think it was 3 minutes later, we had him on the line. He was at some Players Association meetings in Vegas. I knew him well. Kyle didn't. So he came up here and had dinner with Kyle and really got to know each other. Kyle had a great impression, and they had some real honest conversations. And Kyle said, hey, man, go to work and try to get this guy. I want him part of us. And so the next day it was Parag Marate, our contract negotiator, and me in my office that I'm sitting in right now with Richard and his fiance. And about 6 hours later, we came out with a deal. And it was fun to be a part of it. You know, I think he's received a lot of criticism for representing himself. I thought he did a fine job. And I think it worked out that we have skin in the game. He's coming off an Achilles injury. And so we take some risk. He took some risk. But at the end of the day, if he plays like the guy who Richard Sherman has been throughout his career, he's going to make himself whole and some, and we'll be very pleased to pay him that. So I think it's a deal that worked out for both sides, and his influence, one of the coolest things already is to watch the way he's mentoring the younger players, not just at the cornerback position, but throughout our team. And so I think he's going to have a real positive influence, and the Niner fans are slowly getting over the fact because they haven't really liked Richard Sherman and the way he's treated them. But he's one of those guys, when he's not on your team, you don't really like him. But I think these fans will grow to love him as a Niner.
You know, and like you said, John, one of those guys that when he walks in the room, you know he's there. Listen, one last stop before you go. You made it clear last week that Reuben Foster is not going to be a part of the team if he hit a woman. I know there's only so much you can say about that situation because it is an ongoing legal matter, but where do things stand with that situation?
Just there. You know, there's been some recent developments, but we're just going to let those play out in the court system. You know, we understand the serious nature of those charges, and as a result, he's not here working out with his teammates. And, you know, we're we're confident in that decision that it's the right one. And we're also hanging in there and going to let this thing play out. And there have been some recent developments. People can take those for what they are. But, we're hopeful that this thing resolves itself one way or the other quickly. And, we made our statement. If the charges do prove to be true, he won't be a part of us. But I do think that's an if. And so we believe it's prudent to let this thing play out. And that's exactly what we're doing.
49ers general manager, a Super Bowl champion as well. The Niners open up at Minnesota September 9th. John Lynch, my guest. John, so good to get caught up. Really appreciate the conversation and the interview. Thank you very much, John. Great job.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jim. All right.
In baseball, Teddy Ballgame, Ty Cobb, football, Jim Kelly, Dan Marino, golf, Ricky Fowler, or Ricky Fowler. The best to never win one. I mean, it's high praise, but it's definitely a slight, without question. You're regarded as great, but you're great, and you've got a giant anvil hanging over your dome. You're great, but you're not a champion. There are some champions that aren't great, but you can be great. You can be one of the best ever and not be a champion. And I don't care what any of those guys tell you, it hurts. It hurts. Even if it's not their fault and they were never dealt the right hand and never had the right supporting cast, it still hurts. I've been around these guys a lot, and the ones that have a definite distinction between the ones that don't have, because the ones that have will always let the others who don't have know about it. They do. It matters. And the smack off is no different. The hard part is trying to figure out who that person is going to be. All right, so in this program, who is the best to never win one? As an example, is it my man Trapper? Trapper and Dana Point. Not only a legend, but don't lose track of this fact. He's notched 6 top 10 finishes. There are guys that would kill to hit the board a fistful of times. There are guys who kill to hit the board once. There are guys who would kill to be a part of the field. My man has been a top tenner 6 times. He's done it a fistful of times, plus a digit.
You want me on this wall. You need me on this wall. We use words like smack, racked, and made. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have spent my life defending this show. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to clowns who rise and sleep under the blanket of the very smack I provide and then question the manner in which I provide it. I'd rather you just said, thank you, Trapper, and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a phone, swing in here with the big cats, and take your shots.
So there's an argument for Trapper. Trapper might be the best to never win one. How about one of the newer clones? How about Caleb in Green Bay? Now, you might think it's way too early to call this guy one of the best or the best who's never won. Check his resume, though. 3 smack-off calls, 3 top 10 finishes. That's strong. That's consistent. That's consistently strong.
Les has somehow manipulated the clones into thinking he has great sports takes, but literally all he does is make personal appearance jokes about sports figures. Glass houses, I mean, we all do it, but let's not act like Lef calls in once a month to break down the Padres' middle infield or the Raiders' nickel package. I can just picture him at the PTA meetings with the other dads. Hey, Lef, how's it going, man? So what do you think about this LeVar Ball character, huh? Well, his teeth are yellow and crooked, am I right? but I mean, every news outlet is eager for his opinion. Do you think we'll have an effect on the Lakers moving forward? Well, his teeth are yellow and crooked. Ow! Okay, but didn't I see LaMelo pull up from half court the other day? Do you think LeVar is teaching his kids they can call their own shots in life? Well, I know where they can't call their shots. The dentist, right. Well, this is pointless. I'm heading over to the pasta salad.
Caleb, I mean, there's no denying this guy's put himself near the top of the list for smack-off callers that have emerged at least in the last half decade, right? Maybe he's not the best to never win based on that, but then there's this guy. Check this resume. Not 1, not 2, not 3, not 4, not 5. If my math is correct, this guy's got 14 top 10 finishes. That's how long I've been doing this thing. I mean, he hasn't been around forever, but he's been in the top 10 14 times. That's an easy question to answer. If I were to say to you, who's the dude who finished in the top 10 14 times but has never won? you all would know it's Terrence in Sierra Madre.
But at least he's better off than poor old Steve Garvin, who has to constantly tell kids, no, I'm not your dad. I'm Steve Garvin, okay? You want Steve Garvey. He's the one who pumps chicks like a rabbit on crystal meth, not me.
Steve Garvey smack. That's how long it's been since that guy called. 14 top teners, and two of those were good enough for a couple of bronze medals. Now, it has been since 2010 since Terrence made a smack-off call. But he did make arguably the best cameo of all time in last year's event on Left's winning call. Maybe we hear from this guy again. I'm just glad he's not dead. I thought he was. Maybe. Terrence, you're welcome to call. In fact, I would love it if you were to call. Hopefully you can find the show. Because when I hit him up with Terrence, where the hell have you been? I really thought you were in the ground. I thought you were in the ground. Where have you been? He literally said, when they took you off the LA station, Rome, that was it. I just didn't know where to find you. So that's all. I'm like, that's all? Literally, that's why you haven't called the show? Like in 8 years because you couldn't find it? My man, you know we're still on the air. Man, somebody get Terrence a phone. Somebody get Terrence a link. Somebody get Terrence some intel. Terrence, I need you back here. You can do this, Terrence. It'd be one of the greatest stories ever. If you came back from being six feet under and you ripped this thing from today's generation of callers, it would be one of the all-time great things ever. Maybe he trades in the best to never win gloss for a championship belt. Let me open it up to all of you. Hit me up on Twitter at Jim Rome. Who's the best to never win? Do you think Terrence can find this show on July 20th? Does he have the game in 2018 to get it done? Hit me up. Hit me up at Jim Rome. Best to never win it. Do you think that Terrence can do it? Meantime, we're 79 days out. 79 days from Smack Off 24, where time and time again we found out anything at all can happen. Silk won one of these things. Chael Sonnen came out of nowhere to win one of these things. What do you think? Stucknut says, best caller to never win the Smack Off, Terrence. It's not even close. If Stucknut says it. Mac Moore tweets, the best to never win a Smack Off is from Dana Point. Drop the mic. Garbage Man Brad, hands down. Mike in Indy is the best caller that has not won a Smack Off. That's a common crackback that Mike in Indy's never won. Mike has won. Mike has won. Sorta. Mikey, are you coming in this year? That's the big topic right now. Hold up, Alvy. The big question is not who's the best who never win. It's a question. But the bigger question is, where the hell is Mike? And then the other question is, how much is Mike and Indy enjoying that I keep asking, where the hell is Mike? I'm going to answer my own question. He loves it. I haven't spoken to Mike. I haven't had any kind of contact with Mike. I have no idea what's going on with Mike, but it's Mike. Something's going on. He's not coming around. He hasn't come around since we started the simulcast. Brad and Corona came around. I Afraidy came around, but no Mike and Indy. So I don't know what this guy's up to. Maybe he's out. Maybe he bounced, or maybe he's plotting something. I don't know. Where is Mike?
I go hard in the paint because y'all can't.
You used to, Mike. Josh Jackson is my guest. Josh, good to have you on. Good morning. How are you?
Good, man. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Josh, I'm doing great. It's good to visit with you. You got to take me back to the draft first. It was taking place in your hometown. So what did it feel like when you got the phone call from Green Bay? What do you remember most about that phone call?
Man, I just remember sitting at the table, a bunch of, anxiety in the room, just kind of just waiting to hear my name be picked. It was the second day I came back, and, I just remember, seeing the Wisconsin area code pop up and just feeling my heart pound and, just realizing that my dream was really going to come true. And I just remember the gym getting on the phone and just asked if I was ready to be a Packer. And I just told him, heck yeah, man. I'm ready to you know, be with a great organization, just get up there and just get to work.
You know, it's a great organization that said they were surprised that you were still there when their turn came up and that they badly wanted you. What's it mean to you not only to get picked, but to hear an organization like that say how happy they were that you were still on board?
I mean, it's amazing. You know, they're an iconic organization, a winning organization. So for me to be a part of that is, you know, absolutely amazing. And I'm so happy to, you know, join terms with them.
Josh Jackson, my guest. All right, so if we go back a little bit, those who know your story know that you were overlooked coming out of high school in Dallas, but during your time in high school, you completely transformed yourself as a player. You got a lot taller, you got a lot bigger. In fact, your coach, Michael Young, says that you grew about a foot and a half from the time you arrived in high school. How accurate is that, and what were you like as a freshman in high school?
Yeah, really accurate. I just remember, you know, coming in my freshman year, I was, you know, really – I was probably about 5'4", 5'5", and, you know, that summer, you know, I just started working hard, and, you know, I actually hit a, you know, big growth spurt, and by the time I was sophomore, I was about 5'10", and then I just kept growing my senior year. I ended up about 6 foot, and, you know, it just transformed. I got in the weight room a lot more, and, you know, it just changed my, you know, physical stature.
We're talking to Josh Jackson, Green Bay Packer DB. So you go to Iowa, and you start out as a defensive back, but then you move to wide receiver in the spring of 2015, and then you move back to defensive back. So what was that entire experience like?
For me, it was a cool experience. I always wanted to play receiver. And, you know, they were the receiver spot was a little bit down. They lost a couple guys. So, you know, I was one of the most athletic guys to make the transition. So I did that. And then we lost a bunch of DBs. So, you know, I talked to my coach and sat down, and he asked what I wanted to do, and I just told him, you know, I think DB might be the best spot for me to, you know, grow and just be a good player. And so I switched back, and I never looked back since.
Yeah, still, you had a really good attitude about that. That's challenging. I mean, anybody who watched you play last fall knows that you can really play, but you were stuck behind guys like Desmond King, who had a huge rookie season with the Chargers last season. So that meant that you were going to play some nickel. In fact, a lot of nickel. A lot of guys in your situation might have gotten frustrated, maybe even transferred, but you didn't. How come?
You know, just because I knew, you know, Iowa was the best spot for me. I knew I'd be able to, you know, get there and put a good resume up. And, you know, just what I did learn when I was a freshman and sophomore, I looked at the older guys, and I just learned how to, you know, prepare myself, and I learned how to become a better player through mental reps.
So then you get your chance, right? So you get your mental reps, and you wait for your chance, and then you get it, and then all you do is lead the nation in interceptions and passes defensed. So let me ask you this. How much pride do you take in the fact that when you got your chance, you did step up in the biggest way possible?
You know, a lot of pride, because the main thing for me, I just didn't want to, you know, let my teammates down. I knew I had the starting role, and I wanted to do everything I could to, you know, put my team in a position to win and just make sure my teammates respected me and, you know, my preparation and my hard work.
Josh Jackson, my guest. Now, you know the old rap, right? I'm not saying this about you, but you know the old rap about DBs. They play defense because they don't have good hands. Now, again, you led the nation in interceptions, and we're averaging an interception or a pass breakup on one out of every four passes thrown your way. So let me ask you this, in terms of approach, when the ball goes up, how do you approach it? What's your mindset when the ball goes up?
Anytime a ball's come my way and it's, you know, up in the air, my mindset is it's my ball. So that's the kind of how I look at it. Like, I love going up and catching the ball. I just remember Randy Moss doing it whenever he was, you know, a player. And that's, you know, what my mindset is, just to go up and try to moss somebody, just go up and catch the ball. So I love in the air balls. I love trying to go get them.
I'll give you an example. How about that game against Ohio State? You were pretty ridiculous. You had three interceptions, including that one-handed pick that has become an iconic, I mean, a legendary moment. When you look back on that game and when you look back on that interception, what do you remember most?
I just remember, you know, playing cover two. We had a, you know, we had the receiver. I tried to just reroute him inside, and, you know, I showed a little bit behind because I didn't have any threats to the flat. And so I just kind of trailed behind him. I was reading the quarterback and just keeping my distance in between the receiver. I remember he threw it up. And, you know, I could have went and got it with two hands, but, you know, I wanted to, you know, just grab it with one hand. So I just went up there and I did it. It fell in my hand perfectly. And that's pretty much, you know, what happened.
I'm watching it right now. It's great. Josh Jackson, my guest. You know, the thing is, as great a game as that was, one of the things you said back at the Combine was, if you could show teams tape of only one game that you played, it'd be the game against Minnesota. Why that game? What was it about that game that showed the most about how you play and how you approach it?
I think it kind of just showed, you know, my man coverage. A lot of teams are wondering, they want to see more man coverage. So I think that game, that's probably one of my more complete games, just as far as, you know, not giving up a catch, four pass breakups, you know, good tackling. And so I think that was kind of, you know, just an overall complete game for me. And, you know, kind of where, you know, I kind of just started to, you know, transition as a better player that season.
Josh, let me ask you this. After the season ended, you were involved in auctioning off your jerseys to raise money for the UI Children's Hospital. And there's such a special relationship that has developed between Iowa football players as well as Iowa football fans and the Children's Hospital. How would you describe that relationship, and what's it mean for you to be able to raise money for that hospital?
Yeah, man, it means a lot, man, because, you know, just kids, they're really, you know, inspiring to us. We're really inspiring to them. And, you know, for me to be a part of that, just to raise money for the kids, you know, donate my jersey, it's just material things for me. So, you know, I can always get another jersey. But for them, it's, you know, it's a lifetime improvement in their health and improvement in, you know, just their, you know, whole life. And so, you know, just to raise money for them is, you know, a good deed, and I'm glad I was able to do it.
Good for you. Well done. Listen, one last thought. I had Ronald Jones from USC in studio a few weeks back. He's from McKinney, Texas, and he spent a lot of time talking about and hyping up Whataburger. Now, you're from Dallas. Oh. Where do you come out on that burger? Is that the best burger around, or is there something better?
You know, I definitely think it is the best burger because, you know, I grew up eating Whataburger, you know, every other day. So my favorite burger there is A1 Thick and Hearty Burger. No onions, jalapenos, and everything else on it. It's cooked perfectly, and it's just a, you know, perfect hearty burger that you can ever have.
I can respect it, just like I know you'll respect it. I'm from Cali, and I'm all about In-N-Out. Have you had an In-N-Out burger? How does that compare?
You know, it's definitely a little bit different. They have their own, you know, different type of taste, but I think Whataburger is, you know, still on top of In-N-Out, in my opinion.
So what you're saying is by a little bit different, you mean a little bit better, right?
A little bit better, yes.
My man Ken, what's up? Good morning.
Hey, Romy, thanks for taking my call. Hey, man, I'm calling because I'm listening to Barkley make the comments that he's making about Draymond Green. It's like, Barkley, did you forget you were that dude when you played? And once again, I'm not saying that Draymond is a superstar like Barkley was. He's not on that level. But when you look at the stuff that Barkley used to get himself involved in, there's nobody in the league that wants to smack somebody more than Chuck Barkley that the fans want to punch. We could run down a litany of things, spitting on little girls, punching people, punching the guy in the Olympics, you know, with the elbow from a team you've beaten by 100 points, throwing guys through windows. And those are just the kind of stuff that Barkley is known for. There's many stuff, like there's an incident involving him and Oliver Miller in Phoenix where his Phoenix teammates had to tell Chuck, man, that's a bunk move, Chuck. Why could you do something like that? Because he got mad because Oliver Miller punked him, and he ran down the entire court and basically took a cheap shot at the young guy who idolized him. So Barkley was known for doing this kind of stuff. Barkley is the kind of guy that everybody wanted to punch back in the day. And for him to talk like he's probably purebred, come on, Barkley, forget about that stuff, man. You forget who you was and what you were like. And Romy, I'm looking at the Toronto Raptors. The difference in this series, if Toronto this year showed up finally believing they could beat Cleveland, Cleveland showed up knowing that they could beat Toronto. They didn't even sweat it. In fact, I'm pretty sure in Cleveland, they understood that as soon as they got past Indianapolis, they were going to the Eastern Finals because they know. There is no way in the world that Toronto is going to beat them. In Toronto, the term is, it's a legal term, actually. It's called reasonable doubt. There is no way in the world that you believe that you can beat Cleveland. And last night epitomized it. A whole game that you have to shut down and close out, and you can't do it. Cleveland knows that all they got to do is roll themselves out there because they got LeBron, and you guys are done. Romy, thanks for the vine. I'm out.
Go ahead and rock him. I'll see you on July 20th, Ken, if you want to be there. He already earned a golden ticket at the end of last year. Rex in Albuquerque. What's it going to be, Rex? How you doing?
Great, Jimmo. Hope you're doing well. Everybody needs to pump their brakes when it comes to LeBron James and how he's been able to play at such a high level for 15 years. I'll tell you why. First, he entered the league at age 18. Two, he's not driving the lane against the likes of D. Rodman or Bill Laimbeer and getting clotheslined. He largely goes untouched in this no-defense era of the NBA. third, it's reported that he spends in excess of $1 million a year on the maintenance of his body. You got nutritionists, a gaggle of trainers, masseuses, chefs, physical therapists, cryo machines, hyperbaric chambers, etc. He's 33. We're all in pretty good shape and could recover with that kind of budget. Call me when he's still playing at age 53 like Gordie Howe. War smack-offs without gimmicks or tandem calls, in unwar Jeff in San Antonio naming his son Jordan the biggest bag in the history of the NBA. Out.
All right, I'll rack him. If I'm not mistaken, it was his daughter, Jordan, not his son. We go to Louisiana. Trey in Louisiana. Trey, you did it. You made it in. What's going on, Trey? How are you?
Fine. Thanks for the vine attempt. It's been a long road, brother. I've been listening to you for over 20 years. I've had your show with my cold, dead hands and more than once. But all that's over now, Jim. And now that the jungle's on TV, I'm noticing an aspect of your show that I really never thought about. And that's your minions behind the glass. Now, we see the minions daily in their natural habitat. And we all know, getting off the bus, that bad callers are the hot knife and the sparrows are butter. But if you look directly behind the mathematician, you'll see a minion in desperate need of a raise, Jim. I've seen him on more than one occasion sporting that red cafeteria cup, and you know he'd nabbed it from Luby's or some other cafeteria, probably has a whole collection at home. And then there's a squatter. Now, the squatter's only allowed on television once a week, and I'm sure he does a fine job, Jim, but I can't look at him without thinking about that young, nervous, red-shirted ensign of Star Trek who's about to beam down to some planet with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, and you know nothing is happening to them. And then there's Alvy. Dude, I look at Alvy. I just want to mail him a sandwich. The elf needs food badly. And speaking of food, Pimp, I'm sitting here on my days off watching the jungle eating lunch, and it occurs to me that lunch of the monkey, ain't got nothing on lunch with a pip in the box. War, Rex and Albuquerque's father-in-law for letting him borrow his Rolex so little Rexy could pose with it. And unwar any lazy, sneaky, big government-loving, malnourished, frail little Canadians of even thinking themselves worthy of handing Rich Ackerman a snot rag. And war, Leffen Lagunas, marching band, jugglers, and mimes not being able to fit into Romy's studio for the smack-off. And last but not least, Romy, war, Professor Silk, addressing all of his female students and his own mother. Look, brah, I'm Uter Agni.
Trey, gotta rack him. All right, Trey, nice job.
Good night now!